Today's talk is on how right effort could go wrong. How many of you are familiar with the right effort of Noble Eightfold Path? Hands up. How many have heard of right effort? Okay. How many of you know how many right efforts are there in this thing called right effort? How many know the content of it? There are four, right? Although you go like that, but actually there are four. So, to make it easier to remember, the first two of the four has to do with the unskillful qualities, or the akusala dhamma. And the other two has to do with the skillful qualities, the kusala dhamma. So what do we do with them? So let me read out what we can find in the suttas. This is a translation by Venerable Thanissaro. And what monks is right effort? There is a case where a monk generates desire, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds and exerts his intent for the sake of the non-arising of evil, unskillful qualities that have not yet arisen. So, to put it simply, it's about unskillful qualities that has not yet arisen, and there is an endeavor so that it does not arise. Second, he generates desire, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds and exerts his intent for the sake of the abandonment of evil, unskillful qualities that has arisen. Meaning he has come up, and we make an effort to abandon it. So number three and number four has to do with skillful qualities. He generates desires, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds and exerts his intent for the sake of the arising of skillful qualities that have not yet arisen. So it's not there, and he tried to bring it up. And number four, he generates desire, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds and exerts his intent for the maintenance, non-confusion, increase, plenitude, development, and culmination of skillful qualities that have arisen. This monk is called right effort. Now, some of you have heard about the four right efforts, and some of you have only heard of just right effort. You don't know what in the world is it supposed to be about. In fact, that has been how I've been practicing. I've noticed is that that can go wrong. What you think is right effort may actually be wrong effort. Now, if you look at the Noble Eightfold Path, you know, what's it all for? What's the Noble Eightfold Path for? What's the point of the Buddha's teachings for? Liberation from suffering, right? That's the purpose. Not something that the Buddha taught for fun. There's a specific purpose for it. So how can you know if it's right effort? If it works towards that direction, right? So you can know it's wrong effort if you find that if you continue to put on this effort and you're going the other direction, you suffer more. Then you can be sure there's something wrong there. But sometimes people practice and they start to see certain things. They start to see some things that are unpleasant. I'm not talking about those kind of suffering. Speaking of, as whatever you are experiencing right now and the way that you are dealing with it, that itself is creating suffering, then you can know that's the wrong effort. How you are dealing with what's happening, how you're dealing with your practice, the way that you go about it, if it brings about less suffering, then you know you're going the right direction. Let me talk about how it can go wrong. You're talking about working for the non-arising of evil and skillful qualities that have not yet arisen. So let's say you're trying to meditate. And you're trying hard not to have greed, not to have anger, and not to have delusion. And you know that all these things has to do with your thoughts. And so what do? Try not to think. A lot of people go for meditation and they try not to think. You probably notice that when you suffer and you realize that this thinking is happening, so you try not to think. You think there's this idea that this is the thinking that's causing me to suffer. So in order to not suffer, don't think. Right? So this is what we think is called right effort. But when you try not to think, do you feel relaxed or tense? So is that stress or not stress? Stress is dukkha, isn't it? It's suffering, isn't it? So that's how it can go wrong. You try not to think. Try not to think. I know people who try so hard not to think that they can't sleep because it becomes really tense. Well, what they know is that if they think, they can't sleep, so they try not to think and they still can't sleep. So, what to do? So the Buddha's way is not that. It's not about trying not to think. But you realize that thinking is happening. Remember just now when I was leading you in the meditation? I mentioned about thinking. Just a lot of people think that meditation means don't think. If you think, that's wrong. So try not to think. I'm not saying that it's not a good idea to have no thoughts. Sometimes really there are no thoughts, and when the mind is nothing to think about, so there are no thoughts. However, trying not to have thoughts is not the way. The Buddha clearly said that we need to understand the six sensors. The seeing, the hearing, the smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking, or cognizing. Our job is not to get rid of it. Our job is to understand it. What is this thing? And if you can understand these six sensors very well, you can understand anatta, you can understand not self. You can understand that these things are happening, and they are not who you are. If you only try to suppress thinking, how is it possible for you to understand this? It's not possible. But when you realize that thinking, this fellow is talking and talking and, oh boy, this fellow is just who couldn't stop. When you realize that this person is not who you are, for some people that might be a bit scary, but when you realize this person is not who you are, there's a sense of freedom. Oh wow. The first time I noticed this, I realized this. You see, some years back, maybe 5 years back, when my meditation teacher came, sitting, and there's this chattering going on. And then mind was noticing, and somehow the mind turned closer to it, and it suddenly disappeared. It just went off. And that moment, the mind saw that, hey, it was like a dream. It's not real. And, wow, that wasn't me. In that moment, you just feel so relieved. You feel very, very relieved. Wow, that wasn't me. So it's okay what happens to that person who's talking. It's okay, because that's not me, right? The only time when it's not okay for us is because we take it very personally. It's who I am. And this chatterer is just talking about all sorts of nonsense. No, that shouldn't be happening, and try to get rid of it, try to stop it. You see, the right effort here, all four of them, they're telling us these are the things to be done. But it doesn't tell you how yet. The how comes in the next part. That is the right mindfulness. If we mistake this right effort, we try to do it our way, the wrong way. We try to get rid of things, try not to have things, things like that. And therefore it goes wrong. And therefore we stress out ourselves. Okay, let's go to the next one. The next one is about abandoning evil and skillful qualities that have arisen. So let me give you an example. What do you consider to be evil and skillful qualities? What kind of evil and skillful qualities that you try to get rid of? So of all the three defilements, greed, anger, and delusion, I think most people can recognize this as just very unwholesome, unskillful, right? And besides, it's so unpleasant. Greed may be a bit pleasant. So if you like durian, I'm not going to get rid of this. I'll get the durian first. But anger is easy to see, right? So when anger happens, and we think, oh, we need to make the effort to get rid of it. What happens? You try not to get angry. You try to hold it down. Yeah? And when that happens, what happens within you? You feel relaxed or not? No. You feel tense. And if you can't hold it down, anger still happens. You might start to feel a bit frustrated. Then perhaps later on, if you find yourself saying certain things or acting in certain ways, then you start to blame yourself. I'm a bad Buddhist. I must try harder. But because you're not doing the right way, it doesn't work. So next time, it happens again. And again, and again, and again, because you haven't learned yet. Whatever effort you've been using is not the right effort. There was one lady who told me about this issue, and she said, what to do, this thing that comes out? I said, well, let it be. Let it be. When we fight with anger, actually, it's double anger. The anger towards that thing and the anger towards anger. So is that more anger or less? More. So is that wrong effort or right effort? Very clear, isn't it? So the best thing is to let it be. Then you have only one. And the magic about letting emotions be is that they tend not to increase. In fact, if you really, really let it be, they would either just stay almost the same and then they slowly fade away. If you have the right attitude towards it, if you're doing it right. Of course, if you're angry, please don't pay attention to that thing or person that you're angry with. Then you can only go up. Come back and watch the anger itself. And don't try to meddle with it. Don't try to change it. Just let it be. Don't try to get rid of it. It's okay. Besides, not the first time, right? Haven't died the last time, right? So let it be. Just step back. And as my teacher would always encourage people, just take it as nature. It's just nature. Something that has to happen because I'm not an arahant yet. I'm not freed from these defilements yet. So it has to happen. And so we take that as an opportunity to understand anger. That is the Buddha's teachings. How does anger arise? How does it happen? What keeps anger alive? Watch that. That's right effort. So that lady I was telling her, just let it be. No, if you try to suppress it, then you find there's more pressure, more tension. And eventually you can't hold it anymore, and then boom. You say, yeah, I say, that's exactly what happened. Try to hold it down. And then eventually you can't hold it anymore, boom. Sometimes you can hold it down when it's not strongly, when it's not very strong. But that itself doesn't really help you, because then you manage to control that, then what, the next time when you meet with that situation again, is it going to happen again? It happens again because you haven't understood yet. You haven't learned how to deal with it. You haven't learned what is it all about. The causes and conditions for it, for the anger to happen, they're all still there. So when triggered, boom, it comes up. It has to. So our job is not to control our mental state. Our job is to look into the causes, and because we understand the causes just disappear, then the effect cannot happen. Why? So I would, for me, I'll ask the question, why? And really, really to ask the question, why? Not to say, why get so angry? No. Really wanting to know. Now, that's interesting. Anger is happening here. I'm getting irritated, annoyed. So why? What is it about this that I just can't tolerate? Or rather, the mind can't tolerate. Why? Then you get to see. Then you get to understand. And so, right effort is only right when it comes with wisdom. Effort without wisdom cannot be right effort. So when we ask this question, why, we're actually stirring up the wisdom to contemplate, to look, to understand where it's all coming from. And sometimes where it's all coming from can be something that's very deep-seated. It might take you a long time for you to really uncover it, to really understand it, and free yourself from this pattern. But if we keep on wanting to understand and eventually The mind understands more and more and more, and to the extent that it understands, to the extent it is free. It's not something that you can force. So the right effort is like this. Instead of trying to change the experience, it tries to understand. Because it's not trying to get rid of it, then it becomes less and it disappears. And because it really, really tries to understand it, it's possible for it to not arise again. I'll give you an example. I've told this story many times, but I believe some of you have heard it. I had an issue with my teacher. Some of you know about the Anggacitta. Well, at that time I considered him to be rather nitpicky. This one, a little bit also complained. It's okay, ma. Why bother about these little things? So I get really, really irritated. But I also noticed that why the reaction was a bit overboard, too strong. And because of this irritation and then the mind forms, anything that sounds a bit similar to that, boom, it comes up. Therefore, it's overreaction. And sometimes I would say things that are not very nice. The words may not be harsh, but then the tone wasn't right. It wasn't the kind of tone that you used towards your teacher. And after which, I would sometimes feel guilty, and I'd go to his place, say his office, and bow down, and I apologize. And after that, I feel a bit better. But not every time. Sometimes I felt very justified. And those times I don't say sorry. So this thing went on. I go to him. One day this morning I think I didn't behave very well. I'd like to apologize. And he said something like, okay, it's good for us to recognize our faults and that's how we grow in the Dhamma. And so try to be more mindful. I said, yes, Bhante. I bow. And then next time I do it again. So after a few rounds of that, I realized, hey, something's missing. And from that point onwards, I wanted to understand, right? Prior to that, I was just trying to be mindful, expecting mindfulness to solve the problem. But mindfulness is too late. We can only be mindful of something that has already happened. Awareness is not strong enough for the defilement. The defilement has grown to a huge monster. So the awareness has nothing. The defilement is squished dead. So it's too late. If you really, really want to practice so that the evil and unseen qualities does not arise, you can't depend on mindfulness. It's too late. Only wisdom can do that. Only wisdom can prevent defilement. Nothing else can. Not wisdom from somebody else, not wisdom from the book, your own. And we all have. So that we need to grow it. It's like a tree. You can't make the tree grow up, boom, like that. It takes time, it takes the right conditions. So we are putting in the right conditions. You're asking questions, we're taking opportunity to understand what it's all about. Every time you do that, we are actually giving cause for the wisdom to grow. And that's the right effort. Number 3. It generates desire, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds and exerts its intent. For the sake of the arising of skillful qualities that have not yet arisen. And that's what we've been talking about. To create this wisdom. So how did I solve my issue with my teacher? When I was thinking my teacher, my mind was going my father. I've been projecting my father on him. I realized that it was so. In one situation, in one something that happened. Well, one of the things that he complained about me was how I wear my robes. He found it too high. So he would point out and say, Kumara, your robe's too high. And I thought, it's good enough. It's not that high. He's a bit particular about certain rules, particular about how we dress. So he would point out whenever you find that you're not wearing the robes neatly enough. And I find that it's just not necessary. So long as you're well covered, it's fine. But he has a higher standard. And sometimes there are other monks there and he points it out, that's when I don't feel so good. And these monks are younger than me, younger in Vasa age, as in monk age. And sometimes I would sort of just hold my tongue. Don't say anything. But actually, even if you hold your tongue, you can hold your mind. The mind goes... So, and I noticed that this is really suffering for me. And it went on. I still couldn't seem to wear my robe to the standard that he was requiring. Of course, he being still very human, he still has his own stuff. Sometimes the words speak change. It's not just about Kumara, your robe's too high, you come to Kumara, you 10 vasa already, still don't know where you are. There are other monks with just one vasa, two vasa standing next to me. Then later on it became, Kumara, you're wearing miniskirt ah. Wow, that really got me. That really, really got me. And this went on, of course, from this thing, it went to other things, and when we have discussions, sometimes, like, subconsciously, kind of look for opportunities to get back at him. And then I realized, hey, well, that wasn't very, very polite, that was quite rude. But only after that, you see, mindfulness, too late. So when I really, really decided to look at it, and I really wanted to know, why is this happening? Why am I overreacting to so many things? Why are we getting to this tension? Kind of strained relationship. And I realized, I noticed I was trying, and he was trying too. But we still couldn't get ourselves out from it. And of course I can't solve his side, I can only solve my side. So I wanted to look here. I want to look here. I realized that there were times before I spoke to him, I was already programming my mind, okay, I'm not going to react to anything, so I'm going to go to him, I'm going to ask some things. And sometimes, because of an incident that may have happened before that, he comes back in a bit of a harsh tone, a bit of a hard kind of tone. And because I programmed my mind that way, not to react to it, I didn't. Sometimes you can do that, but it wouldn't last very long. And when I did that, then the next thing he said was completely soft. It was very quick for him to change his tone. So I realized that if we want to have a better relationship, then I can't depend just on him. I've got to do my part. And that's true for any kind of relationship issues. Don't wait for the other to change. In order to get into these relationship issues, it needs both sides. You need two to tango. You can't have an argument. You can't have a strained relationship with one side doing it. That's not possible. So you don't need both person to clear their issues. You don't need two persons to clear up their mind. You just need one. If one is clear, then there's just no issue anymore. Because it's just not possible to argue with a person who is clear-minded, who's not arguing back. Try arguing with somebody who's not arguing back. It won't last very long. In fact, that's not even an argument. It's just one-sided. So when I wanted to understand, I didn't understand immediately. I just opened up my mind to this. Okay, I wanted to know. So one day, well, you see, over in my monastery, we walk downhill for alms every day. So every day, we would let the teacher walk first, and we walk behind. And I think subconsciously, I started to walk further behind, so that he doesn't see. So one day, he was like 50 meters ahead, safe distance. And I was back there, because I don't see him, I don't think about it, I was quite peaceful, mindful, just relaxed, walking, very aware. And then it came to a point where it was a bit steeper, and he was down here, I was up here. And then he turned around, and he said, Kumara, your rope's too high! Well, maybe the tone wasn't like that, maybe it wasn't like that, but that's how it sounded to me. But that moment was, something happened, it was different this time. Because I was relaxed, aware, and I had already thrown in this question into mind, wanting to know why, wanting to understand. In that moment when I heard that, I noticed this feeling coming up. And I immediately recognized it. As it was exactly how I felt when my father criticized me or say something about me, particularly in front of others. It was exactly the same. So when the mind recognized that, the emotions just went away. Then I was like, wow, so that's what it's all about. I've been making him my father. I've become a monk, I left that father name, but I got a new father. So from then on, I realized, hey, got to work on that. I haven't forgiven my father for those things that he did. And when we were little kids, we hold on to things very, very strongly. You might think that kids forget about things, but actually, this is all in the subconscious mind. If you grow up, you know, it's still with you. Until we deal with it, it stays on until you die. Things that we dislike a lot, the mind holds very strongly. Things that we like a lot, the mind also holds very strongly when we are kids. Because as kids, we are not very wise. We have a lot of delusion. We tend to think that if something is no good, then it'll be no good forever and ever. Something is really, really good, and we think it's good forever. It's like, I like mango very much. Although nowadays, I find mangoes doesn't really taste as nice as it did when I was a kid. I remember that when I was a kid, I tasted mango, wow, this is nice. And the mind, and it got stuck in the head. Even when I see mango now, I think, ah, nice. But actually, when I taste it, nope, not that nice. So that's how it is. Once the mind believes something is good, it stays on for a long, long time. If it thinks that something is bad, and it stays on for a long, long time. Because of this belief. And belief about something that's good or bad, that's just clinging to that view. So I had my clinging to the view of my father. And I had to look in and see what it's all about. Okay, it means what? It means he's this, he's that, he wants to embarrass me, he's trying to protect his ego, all this stuff. The mind creates a lot of stories, and that's in Buddhism, that's what we call papancha. Papancha means proliferation. Once the mind believes, it holds on to a particular view, and it thinks about it, then it grows. It goes to this, and it goes to that, and it starts to have a whole lot of babies. It's like a virus. And it's worse than a virus. It stays on for a long, long time. This is a mental virus. It's easier to deal with computer viruses. With this kind of virus, this computer is hard to deal with. The only way to deal with it is to understand it. And that's what I did. I looked inside and wanted to understand what it's all about. What are the ideas that I still hold about my father? At that time, I started to realize, why is it that I'm not comfortable with my father? Why is it that when sometimes he tries to recommend me something, he brings me, say, oh, this is good for your health, and all, tries to give me this medicine and all that, some new stuff. And I notice, I just get irritated. Just can't help it. Just happens. Because why? Because I haven't understood it yet. So, but once I'm dealt with it, then I realize that I stop having a problem with my teacher. I just realize that, hey, last time he used to say this particular thing and something similar and I got really, really triggered. This time, hey, it's not happening. I don't have to be mindful anymore. It just doesn't happen anymore. It just doesn't come up. Because it has been understood. And that's how it is that the evil unwholesome qualities that has not yet arisen, that's how they do not arise. So you can't use effort, you can't just use mindfulness. Well, that kind of forcing thing, that's not right effort in the first place, but using mindfulness, that's useful, but that doesn't really get rid of it. Eventually what we need is wisdom. Wisdom of what? It's just the understanding of that thing itself. So whenever anger comes up, that's an opportunity to understand. That's an opportunity to grow the wisdom. Don't see it as a problem. But if you try to fight with it, then it becomes a problem for you. And the last one, for the maintenance, for the non-confusion, increase, plenitude, development and culmination of skillful qualities that have arisen, this monk is called right effort. So what are the skillful qualities? In the Buddhist text, we have what we call the five spiritual faculties. What are they? Confidence, energy or diligence. Chinese they translate it as diligence, jingjing. And then there is sati. Sati is often translated as mindfulness, but I'd rather not use this word because mindfulness is so variously interpreted. There's so many different definitions of it and I'd rather avoid this. Actually, the original meaning of the word sati is remembering. Remembering what? Remembering to be aware. So often people say sati is awareness, but actually it means remembering. But in samasati, the right mindfulness is talking about awareness. So then there is samadhi, often translated as concentration, but that's also something that I think is wrong. I prefer composure, which is how the Chinese translate it too. They translate it as ting. Or if you know Hokkien, it's dia. So it's composure. It's not concentration. And the last one is wisdom. So these five. Confidence, persistence, I like persistence. Then remembering to be aware. Then there's composure and wisdom. Wisdom, understanding, I use these interchangeably. So these are the five things. And how is it possible to develop these five things? We need to remember. Remember to be aware. And it's through this that we cultivate these five. We grow in them. And the stronger these things are, the easier it is to meet suffering, to meet defilements. If these things are weak, it's hard. It's a bit hard going. So we try to cultivate them. Whenever we find it hard, it's only because we don't understand enough. Or perhaps we are not stable enough, we are not composed enough. So what can we do? Well, that's the situation that we're in. We just have to take it as it is. And through that, we grow. When it comes to the maintenance of the good qualities that have already arisen, to build them, what we don't do is try to keep them. What we don't do is try to hold on to them. You can't hold on to mindfulness. When you try to hold on to awareness, you're creating tension. Don't do that. That doesn't work. Sometimes when people meditate and then they notice, oh, this is very nice. What they want to do? They want to prolong it. They want to keep it going. Right there, you have wrong effort. So these are the four efforts, the four right efforts. And I've also explained how things could go wrong. So I hope that by these things that you have learned, you know how to do the right things and not do the wrong things. Right, so it's time for questions.
Hi, Pandey. You said don't suppress anger, right? But if let's say we have friends who are very angry about something, and we don't try to stop them, what if they do something silly or something harsh? Let's say they want to beat somebody up or want to be revengeful and all this. I don't know, maybe some negative thoughts.
So if you feel that there's something that you can do about, you could talk to them, then go ahead. But check yourself first. Are you doing it out of anger? Are you doing it out of fear? Because if you're approaching it with all these negative energies, then it's just increasing more of the negativity. But if your mind is really, really clear, and it's easy for that person to respond to that. If somebody comes to you with a lot of agitation, a lot of tension, a lot of anger, if when we are not skilled enough, we are not established enough in the wholesome qualities or skillful qualities, we find ourselves easily affected, right? So it's just the same way. If this person is like this and you go, you approach with him with these negative ways, do you think it would work very well? So check ourselves first. And don't try to stop him. Because if you try to stop him, he will view you as the enemy. You're not my friend. You're trying to stop me from doing this thing. Rather try to understand him. Same thing. Use wisdom. When you try to understand him, you ask him certain questions. Why do you want to do that? Then it will direct him to question his motivations. But that can only happen if you are stable enough and wise enough. Right, so check yourself first. And sometimes we don't even have to say anything. If the mind is really, really composed, being in the presence of the person, somehow that person can get affected. It's like you're very, very agitated. You go to a person who's really calm. Do you feel a bit more peaceful? Yeah, same thing. So you might not even need to say anything. Just stay with that person, look at the person. Just that presence, I think, would do a lot of good.
Pandey, I'm just seeking clarification in terms of your experience with your teacher. What you have explained is a kind of bottled-up anger, but I'm wondering if you could break it down further, because you explain it in such a way that it just disappeared. I didn't quite get how the bottled anger just disappeared by wisdom. I was wondering whether you can break it down
further. Okay, alright. I think in my case, there wasn't too much of bottled anger, but there was a lot of clinging to certain ideas about my father. And these ideas continue to generate these negative emotions. you continue to generate them. So long as there's clinging, these things will happen. It has to. With clinging, suffering must happen. So it was more of those that I need to work on. And I need to identify, and then the question, I need to watch the clinging. I need to see how it is painful to cling on. You need to really, really get to the seeing of the clinging itself. Not just thinking of the clinging, but you really see, wow, this idea when the mind holds on to it, it's really unpleasant, it's really stressful. So the more the mind sees it, the more it doesn't want to hold on to it. And then as it lets go of a bit and bit, and then there's also the gaining of confidence that, hey, this is the right thing to do. It's not just about trying to cycle yourself to believe that, oh, that kind of faith is direct faith. It's something that you have experienced for yourself and you know, yeah, actually it does work. So you continue. It didn't just go off very, very quickly. In fact, when I realized that, it took me time even for me to be willing to look at it again because it's not something that's pleasant. But after a few more rounds of this unpleasant encounter with my teacher, okay, I don't care what happens, I want to look into this. Because these are things that the mind has been trying hard to forget, trying hard to not remember. So there's a strong tendency to avoid this unpleasant thing. But if it wants to be free, it knows that it needs to look at it again. And it has to. There's no other way out.
How does the looking at the clinging remove the clinging itself?
Okay, when it comes to clinging, there are three things to look at, according to the Buddha's teachings. One is the gratification. Yes. There's a gratification in clinging to some things. Like for example here, there's a gratification of saying he's wrong. Of course, the idea of he's wrong and I'm right. I'm the good guy, he's a bad guy. And you feel good being the good guy. There's a gratification there. One lady who, after attending one of my calls, she went back and she emailed me and said, "Now I used to think that I hate arguing with my husband, but now I realize that actually I enjoy it. I like it. I like blaming him. I like to see him as the wrong one. I like it." So that's the gratification. All the clinging has some gratification. If there's no gratification, why cling on, right? Does it make sense, right? There's some kind of gratification. You might not even notice, you might not realize it. And you might not even see it as gratification, but there is. There's this thing. What for? Why do we cling on to things when there's no gratification at all? There's something to it. And sometimes it could be so subtle, it's just a matter of the identification with it. That this is who I am. Me, the victim. Me, the one who wasn't treated well. There's some kind of gratification in holding on. It's perverted, but it's still a kind of gratification. And the next thing to see is the drawbacks. This is easier, of course. Especially when it comes to something that you have suffered a whole lot over. The drawbacks or the disadvantage of the clinging. You see the clinging and see how it hurts. Ultimately, we don't want to suffer, right? But we can't free ourselves unless we see how we are creating suffering for ourselves. We need to really look at it. But normally we don't want to look at it because we don't want to feel it. Which is how we are coping with it. We are avoiding. That avoidance itself is preventing our own freedom. So if you want to be free, you need to look at it again and again and again and again and again. Like when I was young, my father used to hit me. There's this, of course, the thought that he shouldn't hit me. And then there's, of course, the thought, man, what it means if he hit me? It means what? It means he doesn't love me. So I look at these thoughts and question them. Is it true? I remember one time I just sat with it. I sat with that question for almost an hour. And then during the whole period, there was this feeling, this sensations happening here. It's like all those stuff. Maybe for some people it could be stronger. Mine was like on the mild side, but it's still there going shh. Well, I'm going to make a sound out of it so that you could know how it's like. Like, of course, it doesn't go shh. So it takes effort. It really, really takes effort. But only the right kind of effort actually frees us. It takes the diligence to keep watching and not quitting. Meditation need not be pleasant. Meditation is not about getting the blissful states. That might happen sometimes. Meditation is about understanding. So the understanding can happen while we are having pleasant experiences, or you can be having unpleasant ones. And it doesn't matter. Pleasant, unpleasant, to a meditative mind, it doesn't matter. Important thing is there something for me to understand here? Can I look and understand things, these things? So when the mind sees the gratification and it sees the disadvantages, then it can see whether or not this clinging is worth it. Is the gratification worth the disadvantage? Is it worth it? If there's enough wisdom, surely it sees that, no, it's not worth it. Then the more it understands, the more it sees that it's not worth it, the more it's willing to give it up. And this understanding is not intellectual, it's not trying to figure it out. We need to see the actual clinging. We need to see the actual gratification, the actual disadvantage. Just thinking about it is not good enough. It helps direct the mind, but that doesn't free us yet. Then the last one is freedom. Freedom from what? Freedom from the clinging. How would we be without this clinging? Is it worth it? How would life be without this clinging? How would my relationship with this person be without this clinging? How would I live my life? How would I even just be here without this clinging? Is that a good idea? Would that be a good idea, to cling or not to cling? So when the mind looks into this, the more it understands, the more it's willing to give it up. And it's because it understands that it gives up. Not because it tries to give up, tries to let go. Letting go is such a Buddhist mantra now. Let go, let go, let go. Easy to say, huh? But actually, if you want to let go, what's necessary is the understanding. You just can't tell yourself, let go, let go, let go, let go. It doesn't work that way. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
My question, I don't know if it's related to today's topic, but please correct my understanding of right effort. So of all the Buddha's teachings in books and lectures and talks that I've learned from, they advise accepting life and reality and truth in the present moment. But what about planning in reality in life? It requires a lot of planning for family, for career development, for advancement, or towards excellence in every aspect of our life. What is the Buddhist view of all these concepts? Are all these considered defilements or illusions or wrong effort or wrong goals?
For as long as the mind has not really understood, our thoughts will have to have defilements. We can't really have thoughts that has no defilements. Particularly delusion. They have to be there. But about that point of making plans is not a problem. Say you plan to come here. Was that wrong? So we make plans. Planning itself is not an issue. It's only an issue when we cling to our plans. That's where we suffer. Okay, I already planned all this out already, now don't come and catch out. Right. I already planned all this out, then it rained. That's when we suffer. And we cling to our plans. We can have goals. Well, the Buddha had a big, big goal before he became a Buddha. That's huge. We don't say that was wrong. It was necessary. He wanted something that was way beyond most people. Way, way beyond. So we don't say that that's wrong effort. But I just need to do it the right way. If we plan, we plan. Okay, I plan to do this, but I don't know whether it's going to turn out that way. But that's my plan. And I do it because I think it's useful, it's necessary. Even if it doesn't turn out right, it was still useful and necessary. That was my idea. If I do it thinking that I have to be successful, I have to make it happen, that becomes a problem. So we just really need to check, does it create suffering for us? When we plan for something and work towards something, there's a tension in it. Then that tells you, hey, I need to check my motivation, I need to check my attitudes, am I doing it in a way that's free or in a way that's tightening, stressful? Like, where before I came here, I was told we were supposed to leave at 6:30, particularly when there was a rain, where we might be late if we start off too late. But the driver, the person who was coming, didn't arrive at 6:30. It was 6:40 and 6:45 and 6:50. And I was like, okay, he's not here, he's not here. But if you could do something about it, well, his man was suggesting maybe he could drive, check, okay, check. But to worry about it, to insist that we must be there on time, now that would create stress. There was also one time when I was in Malaysia, somebody came really late, and there was a jam. And while we're in the jam, I'm already supposed to be there according to schedule. Then he took a wrong turn into a busier place, more jam. And I thought, I was just watching my mind. Any stress there? And I realized that, well, not too much. I was sitting there, the car wasn't moving. There was rain outside. I'm still here. And I don't know what they are thinking, but well, they have to think what they think. So sometimes in between, mine would go like, why did he take the wrong turn? Then, knowing that wasn't necessary, it just fade off. Then when my mind was clear, then I could start to think. Now he wanted to take this way, and then I know that this way wouldn't be the best way to go there, although this is a wrong turn. Then it occurred to me, hey, we should go that way. I think that's better. And he didn't know the way, actually. But I think I know a little bit. So I think this is better. And so he took that way, and then we were there earlier compared to if he had went on the way that he wanted to. So, but that could only happen when I'm not grumbling, I'm not complaining about it at the time. If I were to continue to do that, then I was in a mood of thinking what solution we could take. So because the mind was settled, it became clear, oh, hey, we could take this way. Okay.
One thing. When we try to investigate something, like just now you mentioned that you try to investigate your emotions, how do we know that we are not over-intellectualizing it? Really thinking and not trying to understand the situation or understand our own emotion in order to resolve it.
When you use intellect, then just using intellect, you try to figure it out, you don't find yourself freer. It can be very obvious. You don't find yourself freer. You find yourself going around. And just know it's not working. You just know that you're not free. So that's how you know. It's very easy. So that's not the way, trying to figure it out. When we ask questions to the mind, we're throwing these questions in the mind. We're feeding the mind with questions. We are not doing so insisting an answer. Like say, if you tend to get angry over certain things, and you know that this is just way beyond normal behavior, it's really, really overreacting, you might not get the answer immediately. It might take you days, it might take you months, it might take you even years. But you are interested to know. Even if you don't find the answer yet, actually wisdom is growing. Because whenever we ask these kind of questions, we are stirring up wisdom, which we all have. We are making it work. Most of the time we are not making wisdom work. We're making delusion work. Or rather, delusion is making us work. So, if you try to figure it out, you will know that you're not doing it right because it's just going around. And if you really, really just want to know, it is not an insistence, you find that it's like you're not in a hurry. You're not in a hurry to get it. But you're interested.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.